Welcome to the S&P Global Platts Oil Markets Podcast. I'm Frank Watson, Senior Writer on the EU Emissions Trading System at Platts, and today we're talking about aviation fuel markets, and in particular, sustainability of jet fuels, and wider efforts to manage the aviation sector's carbon footprint. And after that, please stay tuned for the IMO 2020 podcast with Tamara Sleeman. I'm joined today by two Platts colleagues, Emma Thomas, Associate Editor of Jet Fuel, and Hugh Shortland, Associate Editor on Agriculture and Biofuels. Welcome to you both. Sustainability in the aviation sector's carbon footprint are two aspects in particular that make this a challenge for aviation. Global air transport is responsible for just over 2% of global CO2 emissions, but that share is forecast to grow, potentially as much as 300 to 700% by 2050 from 2005 levels, according to the European Commission. Now that's a problem because governments, regulators and the industry are coming under pressure to reduce the sector's environmental impact. Aviation is also seen as one of the more difficult to decarbonize sectors, while its international dimension also makes it less suitable for regulation at the national level. All these pressures and complications create a unique set of challenges for the industry, and momentum has been building in recent years to navigate a way through to real sustainability. One major part of that is the use of more sustainable fuels such as biofuel. Emma, what are you seeing from airlines at the moment in terms of reducing their environmental impact?
So there are a few factors that airlines have taken on board to improve the efficiency of their aircraft. The newer aircraft that are coming online are more efficient to start with. There are new engines, there are new technologies, and new materials are used. So, for example, material that is much lighter, and therefore the actual aircraft is not as heavy and they burn less jet fuel. Wings are more slender and better designed to remove drag and improve aerodynamics. The engines are cleaned so that they burn jet fuel more efficiently. Some aircrafts have removed seats or made the seats out of lighter material too. Air traffic control has also improved, so they have more direct flight paths. So this is an area that works so long as geopolitical issues remain calm. For example, after the plane was shot down in Iran, airlines did have to divert around the region. And the detour will only burn slightly more jet fuel, but nevertheless, more jet fuel will be burned. But the most jet fuel is used during takeoff. One can also be quite cynical about these sorts of improvements and say that it aligns with the airline's bottom line. But nevertheless, they are working towards improvements. And in aviation, one must always remember that the first principle is always safety.
Okay, and to what extent is sustainable aviation fuel disrupting the market for traditional jet fuel?
Right, so we spoke to a representative from the International Air Transport Association, IATA, and they discussed sustainable aviation fuel, also known as SAF. And it currently only accounts for 0.01% of global jet fuel use. However, the aviation industry wants to increase that to around 2% by 2025. And they think that when they reach 2%, that'll be a tipping point and it'll create a more active SAF market. Sustainable aviation fuel is blended with the petroleum Jet A1, and it meets the Jet A1 DEFSTAN specifications. So by adding the SAF component, they're lessening the environmental footprint of flying. But it's important to remember that the SAF, the sustainable aviation factor, isn't actually going to replace traditional Jet A1. It's something that's added to the product to make it more environmentally friendly. And whatever happens with jet fuel, like we said earlier, the initial focus is always safety. There are very stringent jet fuel specifications. So, for example, the flash point has to be around 38 degrees Celsius, and it's got a maximum freeze point of 47 degrees Celsius. And this remains a hurdle for only using sustainable aviation fuel.
Okay, now cost is and will be critically important for this development. How affordable is this sustainable fuel as it stands?
Yeah, that's a good point. We have seen the cost of sustainable aviation fuel diminishing, but as it stands at the moment, the numbers that we're hearing in the industry are still 1.5 to 4 times more expensive than the traditional Jet A1 petroleum-based product.
Okay, so as Emma has outlined, one of the longer-term options to decarbonize jet is the use of biofuels, including biojet. Hugh, what can you tell us about the bio component of biojet and how is it derived?
So the bio component of renewable jet is something called HVO, which is also known as hydro-treated vegetable oil, and it is part of the biofuel sphere. And biofuels have been used for a while now to try and decarbonize transport, And the reason is that it's been mandated by the European Union. Governments have been left to decide how they meet those targets, but those overarching biofuels blending targets come from the European Union. And particularly as we look towards the next 10 years, particularly 2030 and the RED II, so by 2030, they want 14% of renewables in transport. And HVO has been a part of that, particularly for the last 5 or 10 years. And the companies that you see producing HVO are the likes of Preem, Neste and UPM in Scandinavia, Total in southern France, you've got Eni in Italy, Cepsa and Repsol in Spain, and then you also have Neste again with their plant in the Netherlands. And the interest towards HVO is growing, particularly in those hard-to-decarbonize sectors, particularly something like aviation where electrification is far more difficult. Part of that is due to the weight of the batteries. And also, you know, if you try and refuel with electricity halfway between London and New York, it's not really going to work. So I think that's why the interest towards sustainable aviation is growing.
So it's clear that industry is starting to move forward on the use of these fuels. But how cost effective is this? You know, what are the challenges in terms of further uptake of these fuels?
So the problem with HVO at the moment, particularly in road transport, is its cost. It is much more expensive than the other options. For example, something like RME, which is rapeseed methyl ester, and other biofuel components. And it's an awful lot more complex process than producing traditional biodiesel. Traditional biodiesel is produced via methanol and a catalyst. However, HVO utilizes hydrogen, and the investment that you have to put into a plant is much, much greater. You look at the investment in somewhere like La Med, which is Total's plant, you know, you're talking several hundred million euros. It's a different game. The other thing is that if you look at the feedstocks for HVO, something like a UCO is already used in the biodiesel sphere for UCOME, used cooking oil methyl ester. The problem is that for a UCOME is that the parameters that you need, there's only around 3 or 4. However, with something like a HVO, the parameters are about, as one person said to me, they're as long as your arm. You'll have to look at heavy metal content. It's a very different set of parameters for HVO versus UCOME. And HVO fully meets the RTFO, the UK standard, and can be used as 100% fuel. So the other name for HVO, particularly in the US, is renewable diesel, because effectively you can blend it straight in, or you could run your car 100% on renewable diesel. Again, though, you know, we talked about UCO earlier, but the other main feedstocks are particularly palm oil, UCO, PFAD and tallow, and there is clamour to get rid of palm oil from the feedstock side, particularly with concerns around sustainability and all the, you know, the activism that's gone on around palm oil.
One thing that's interesting to mention about palm oil is when we spoke to the International Air Transport Association, they said that the industry is, you know, rightly so scrutinized by the media. Therefore, they want to stay away from including palm oil as part of their sustainable aviation fuel. So they're looking for sustainability to really be the focus in the sustainable aviation fuel. And that isn't always or seen to be the case with palm oil.
And Hugh, what sort of demand are you seeing for these fuels at the moment and going forward?
So going forward towards 2030 again, demand is set to increase to 6 million tonnes in 2030, and that's up from 2.2 million tonnes from 2019. And that's just in road transport. That's not looking at, you know, sustainable aviation fuel or possibly even maritime fuels. That's purely road transport. The feedstock again is going to be an issue. As I said before, you know, 2030, the European Union doesn't want to see palm oil being burnt in its transport sector. However, again, they've put some interesting criteria. You can use palm oil in road transport. However, it has to meet 3 different criteria. It has to be farmed in under 2 hectares from degraded land and also from production increases. And we've seen that some companies have moved away from palm oil already. For example, if you look at Neste's results for 2019, their full year results, they discussed how their renewable diesel, HVO, was made with 80% wastes and residues. They have increased their renewable diesel capacity to 3 million tonnes from 2.7 million tonnes at the start of 2019. They are also looking to produce 1 million tonnes of renewable jet fuel globally in 2022. And, you know, as we said before, talking about sustainability and moving away from palm oil, it looks like Neste is already moving towards that. You know, and again, it'll be a real fight for feedstocks. You see a lot of UCO imported from China to meet the demand for what's described as sustainable feedstocks, and that's only set to increase as HVO capacity increases in Europe. There is UCO produced in Europe, however, it's not enough, and they will look to abroad to import it. So I think this is going to be a very interesting space to watch, particularly on the fuel side, but also on the feedstock side as well. The main reason they are looking at HVO is its coal properties. It is a brilliant candidate for renewable jet fuel, and I think its CFPP is something from minus 15 to minus 34, so it's a very good candidate for jet fuel. However, there is, as we said before, and I think there's a lot of this is, you know, the conflict between air, road, and sea. If you look at somewhere like Belgium, they have a blending mandate of 9.6% of biodiesel. However, you can only use a B7 fuel, which is maximum 7% biodiesel. So therefore, you have to blend HVO. So this sort of conflict between all three sectors is going to continue, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops, particularly as, you know, countries look at hydrogen, look at electrification of their road transport.
Okay, and one of the other groundbreaking developments in the sustainability of aviation is CORSIA. That's the Carbon Offsetting and Reduction Scheme for International Aviation. This is the world's first global market-based mechanism for reducing emissions in an entire sector. The CORSIA system has been agreed under the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization. Its goal is to offset aviation's CO2 emissions growth above a 2020 baseline. So what does all this mean for airlines? Well, starting in 2021, airline operators will have to offset any emissions over and above their 2020 levels by purchasing carbon offset credits. This is going to be on a voluntary basis initially, and this is expected to have a small impact at the beginning, but it could become more significant over time as the industry continues to grow. In essence, airlines will have to either invest directly in emissions reduction projects to offset their emissions or buy the credits in a secondary market. And that brings us to the price. What are these credits actually going to cost airlines? Well, the price will be determined by the balance between supply and demand. Demand will be determined by CO2 emissions from the consumption of jet fuel above the 2020 baseline, and the supply will be determined by the rules on the eligibility of projects and the volume that project developers are willing to supply. This still leaves a lot of uncertainty, because if the eligibility rules on offsets are more strict, this will constrain supply and lead to relatively higher prices for the offsets. However, if the rules are more lax, the system could be flooded with too many credits, and as a consequence, offset prices will be much lower. And of course, this has happened before with other attempts to put a price tag on CO2 emissions. One example is the UN's Clean Development Mechanism, and also, for a while at least, the EU Emissions Trading System. This could mean aviation carbon offset prices are too low to have a meaningful impact on airlines' fuel consumption decisions compared with other environmental regulations. So it's going to be interesting to see if regulators can design these markets in a way that supply and demand are brought into some kind of equilibrium. I recently spoke to a company executive who deals in the biofuel sector, and he thinks it's more likely the CORSIA system will be oversupplied and offset prices will be very low as a consequence. If so, the question will become whether the regulators are willing to tighten the rules to limit supply and therefore lift the price of these offset credits. Another interesting development is the coronavirus outbreak in China. In a special report released January 23rd, Platts Analytics said global jet fuel demand across 2020 could be down by around 2-4% against its prior reference case due to the coronavirus. Now, this matters because the baseline for global aviation's emissions is based on 2020 emissions. So a drop in consumption of jet fuel means a lower, more stringent baseline from which the aviation industry will have to measure its carbon neutrality. That means potentially a bigger offsetting obligation than would have otherwise been the case. And this could matter also for airlines' ratings. In a report in November 2019, S&P Ratings said over the long term, any impact on airlines may be partly determined by their ability to pass through costs to passengers. So in summary, expect airlines to do a lot of investing in carbon offset projects, such as forestation programs and other carbon sequestration projects. But whether this CORSIA system has any significant impact on fuel decisions is less clear at this stage. Emma and Hugh, thanks very much. Thank you for listening. For more news about the aviation fuels market and other insights and analysis on other commodities, visit spglobal.com/Platts. And stay tuned. Coming up next, our IMO 2020 special with Tamara Sleeman.
Hello and welcome to our special IMO 2020 edition of the S&P Global Platts Oil Markets Podcast. I'm Tamara Sleeman. With me today are Sarah Jane Flaws and James Goldburn, our market experts looking closely at fuel oil markets in Europe. Now, what we've been seeing recently is a downward pressure on 0.5% marine fuel prices, a big contrast from what we were seeing at the start of the year and in November 2019. Sarah Jane, do you think you can give us an idea of the reason behind the downward pressure on prices?
Correct, Tamara. We have seen downward pressure on the 0.5 marine fuel. This has been both in Europe and over in the East. But over in the East, we have seen demand really, really fall off. So post IMO 2020, we saw premiums surge. This was on high demand and very little supply within the region. Now, with Lunar New Year and on the back of the coronavirus outbreak in China, we've seen a slowdown in demand from Singapore. So typically, Singapore would export 0.5 marine fuel into the region. But now with this demand falling off, we are seeing more supply build up over in Singapore. So we're seeing an arb from Europe for the 0.5 to head over into the East on these very, very high premiums compared to the European market.
Yeah, and if we look at the paper market, the 0.5% east-west spread for March, back in January we saw numbers trading at around $35 per metric tonne. This week we've been seeing offers of around $20. So that's more than $15 lost in the space of a month. And essentially what that means is it's making it less attractive to send product from Europe over to Singapore.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to see the east-west spread fall off, which basically measures the arbitrage opportunity for someone to take product from Europe to Singapore. What we've been hearing is that about 3 million metric tons of 0.5% marine fuel and low sulfur components are expected to move east, but I'm not quite sure if that's expected to change with coronavirus hitting the market. Now, do you think you can give us an idea of how all this is impacting fuel oil prices in Europe?
So within Europe, we have seen prices come off. So on our 0.5 marine fuel assessment, we've seen values from, say, the 3rd of January fall off 25% compared to our assessment on February 18th. This has been mostly attributed on the back of coronavirus, with the demand falling off over in China, hence this now impacting Singapore and the call on the arb being less than what it was before. However, I've been hearing within Europe that this is not a case of supply build-up, it's more of a demand kind of pull down. So with there being less pull in the arb over to the east, we could see more supply, you know, remaining within the European market, so more offers could become available. However, the 0.5 has been in tight supply. But with values coming off 25%, it's kind of showing you that the premium and the risk factor of the market is kind of coming out. But who knows what this is going to bring.
And if we look at the paper market again, if we're looking at 1% FOB NWE cargoes against 3.5% FOB Rotterdam barges, known as the high-low, and it's important because 1% has been used primarily as a blending component. Value for that has fallen below $100 per metric tonne for the first time since IMO was implemented. So what that means is it's lost more than half of its value in the space of a month. Early January, it was trading at around $216 a barrel. This week, it's been assessed at $97 a barrel. So that's, you know, about 55% drop in value. And a similar thing has been seen in the 0.5% marine fuel forward curve as well, generally all in the prompt. So value really is coming off, and it seems to be a rebalancing post-IMO.
And would you say other products are being impacted by this? Let's say 1% fuel oil or low sulfur straight run, you know, the products that were attractive blend stocks for the 0.5% marine bunker fuel.
Yeah, so low sulfur straight run, which has been redirected to be used as a blending component for marine fuel, we've seen marine fuel values come down. Straight run values, they've also come down by quite a bit. We're looking at kind of about a 30% drop in value. So previously we've spoken about straight run's use as a feedstock and as a blending component, and there's been this real tug of war between the two because straight run's been priced out of its use as a feedstock. Now these values have come down. The question is where this product is actually going to end up.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time today, Sarah Jane and James. For more news and insight, please visit spglobal.com/plats. Thank you for joining us on this week's IMO podcast. We look forward to you guys joining us again soon on the next installment.